content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the December 15th, 2023 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows former President Donald Trump standing, looks like a balcony, maybe on the Capitol. He's dressed in a kind of a khaki military outfit with medals, and he's wearing a hat. He's got his right fist raised. Over to his right behind him is his advisor, Stephen Miller, also dressed in a military outfit. The presidential seal is on the railing in front of him, but it's a little different. It says, "The President for Life of the United States." The headline is, "Dictator in Waiting: How a Second Trump Term Could Upend Democracy." That story comes on the Talking Points page. We'll start today with the two shorter main stories. With Congress deadlocked, U.S. aid to Ukraine dries up. What happened? The Biden administration warned this week that Congress' failure to pass emergency military aid immediately would kneecap Ukraine on the battlefield, saying the U.S. would soon run out of money allocated to assist the country in its fight against Russia. Republicans from both houses of Congress said they would consider more aid, but they insisted that funding must be accompanied by sweeping changes to U.S. border policy. In the House, Republicans demanded passage of a bill drafted last spring that would severely restrict the right to seek asylum. In the Senate, Republicans stormed out of a Ukraine briefing when it became clear that border security was not on the agenda. President Biden accused the GOP lawmakers of playing chicken with our national security. If Ukraine falls, he said, Russia could push farther into Europe, raising the specter of American troops fighting Russian troops. A high-level Ukrainian delegation, including the defense minister and head of parliament, met with congressional representatives this week to plead its case. With its counteroffensive sputtering, Ukraine faces a beefed-up Russian military that is to receive $109 billion next year, nearly a third of Russian spending. But the Pentagon has already disbursed 97% of the $62 billion in aid earmarked for Ukraine. Andriy Yermak, chief of staff to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, said that if nothing else arrives, Ukrainians are at big risk of losing the war outright. What the columnist said. Republicans have issued a ransom demand, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg. They are insisting on every provision in their failed Secure the Border Act, which would cut virtually all services for asylum seekers, roll back safeguards for migrant children, and make employers check workers' papers. At this time, even senators are in on the legislative extortion. This is not a traditional negotiation, said Senator John Cornyn, Republican from Texas, but a price that has to be paid. Biden has neglected the border to a shocking extent, but that's not Ukraine's fault, said National Review in an editorial. Given that Republicans will not get all they are asking for on border security, they should consider pushing for a more achievable goal, such as more detention facilities and meaningful restrictions on the number of migrants who can enter the U.S. provisionally. Refusing to pass Ukraine aid at all would be national security malpractice. As Russia rains down bombs on heating infrastructure, millions of Ukrainians will have trouble surviving the winter without U.S. help, said Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic. But more than humanitarian concerns are at stake. Allowing Russia to swallow Ukraine would create a Europe where Poland, the Baltic states, and even Germany are under constant physical threat. It would empower Iran and other bad actors and embolden China to attack Taiwan. If only out of self-interest, the West must defeat Russia. House kicks out Santos over lies, scandals. After becoming the first member of Congress to be expelled in more than 20 years, George Santos spent this week railing against the former congressional colleagues and selling personalized videos online. The New York Republican, who's charged with 23 felonies, including stealing from donors to fund a luxurious lifestyle, was formally removed from the chamber in a 311 to 114 vote. 105 Republicans voted against him. He greeted the news by declaring, "To hell with this place." Santos accused colleagues of attending House votes drunk and threatened to file ethics complaints against three New York Republican representatives. He is the first representative since the Civil War to get booted without a criminal conviction. But the House was moved to act by an ethics committee report that found an extensive trail of misdealing with campaign funds allegedly used to pay for Botox treatments, designer clothes, vacations, and the adult website OnlyFans. New York Governor Kathy Hochul scheduled a special election to replace Santos, who continues to deny any wrongdoing, for February 13th. True to form, Santos bounced back with startling speed, creating an account on Cameo, a service that lets people pay for personalized messages from public figures. His videos sold for up to $300, with his earnings surpassing his congressional salary of $174,000 in just 48 hours. He also said he planned to write a book and would consider appearing on Dancing with the Stars. "Look, they can boot me out of Congress," he said in one video, "but they can't take away my good humor or my larger-than-life personality." What the columnist said: "The great prevaricator went out living his best life," said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. He sneered at the House, saying, "No real work is getting done." But the dishonest, vindictive, and ineffective Santos neatly defined the current House. He even lied about knee injuries he didn't sustain while not playing volleyball on a scholarship he did not receive for the college he did not attend. He's a perfect distillation of this moment, a Trumpian extreme in a long history of congressional scoundrels. The expulsion sets a worrying precedent, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. There were previously a clear, neutral, limiting principle. Representatives needed a criminal conviction to get thrown out. What's the rule now? Santos was clearly disreputable, but the House has lowered the bar in a way that partisans will be tempted to abuse. His colleagues wanted him gone, but they may come to regret that they didn't leave his fate to the courts and the voters. This was an act of political repair, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. Yes, ousting him violated a long-standing norm, but Santos had zero loyalty to norms of conduct. No other institution requires a criminal conviction to fire someone. This standard is as nonsensical for a congressperson, or for that matter, for a president. Expulsion and impeachment don't deny anyone life and liberty, as criminal cases do. They merely deny politicians power. Let's worry about the unintended consequences when someone undeserving loses that privilege. Our controversy of the week: Kissinger, a great statesman or a war criminal? Henry Kissinger's death last week at 100 was a tragedy, said Ariel Dorfman in the Los Angeles Times, because now he will never stand in a court of law and answer for his crimes. As National Security Advisor and Secretary of State for Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, Kissinger authorized some of the bloodiest atrocities in American history. He approved the secret bombing of neutral Cambodia during the Vietnam War, a 1969-73 campaign that killed tens of thousands of civilians and fueled the rise of the Khmer Rouge, who killed 2 million more. In Vietnam, Kissinger prolonged for 3 years an unwinnable war to preserve American credibility, and he greenlit the 1971 massacre of perhaps 300,000 Bengalis by U.S. allied Pakistan. All this carnage, Kissinger insisted, was in defense of U.S. interest, but he showed his disdain for those most sacred interests, democracy and human rights, when he backed the 1973 overthrow of Chile's rightfully elected socialist president, Salvador Allende, ushering in the murderous regime of General Augusto Pinochet. As a young American soldier, Kissinger helped liberate the Nazi death camp where my grandfather was a prisoner, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. But he would later unleash monstrosities himself, all in the name of American supremacy. That's cartoonishly simplistic, said David Ersani in the New York Post. Far from being a bloodthirsty supervillain, Kissinger extricated the U.S. from Vietnam and, with rounds of shuttle diplomacy, brokered a ceasefire between Israel and its Arab neighbors in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. And he did it while navigating the Cold War between nuclear-armed superpowers, said Joseph S. Nye, Jr. in Foreign Affairs. Kissinger's decision to pursue détente with Moscow while sending Nixon to China, thus stoking divisions between the two communist powers, made the world safer. Were there hard trade-offs along the way? Yes, but these were amoral choices to prevent even greater catastrophes. Human rights do not exist, he understood, among those incinerated in a nuclear war. Kissinger excelled at the international game of chess, said George Packer in The Atlantic, but his shocking indifference to human life and misunderstanding of human nature often clouded his long-term vision. In his overtures to Beijing, Kissinger didn't foresee that tying together the U.S. and China could damage America's manufacturing base and empower Chinese authoritarians. The humiliating collapse of the Soviet Union, which he helped orchestrate as advisor to Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, created a bitterly resentful Russia that is now once again threatening peace in Europe, said Simon Tisdall in The Guardian. At least Kissinger lived long enough to see his greatest achievements exposed as fleeting mirages of détente. It's easy to dismiss Kissinger as a cold-blooded exponent of realpolitik, said The Economist in an editorial. Yet his often cruel statecraft was shot through with idealism. His life's work, Kissinger said, was devoted to preventing another world war. Such cataclysms can be avoided, he believed, if states tolerate each other's differences and ignore zealots and proselytizers who are quick to condemn and who demand change over a point of principle. What Kissinger saw in the concentration camps helped him understand that the greatest threat to morality is the anarchy and slaughter of great power conflict, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. It must remain our priority as we enter the post-Kissingerian age to protect our increasingly fragile civilization from the ravages of war. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for stamina after Lisa Craig of Colorado finally received her unemployment benefits, having spent 278 hours, the equivalent of 11 full days, over 6 months on hold with the state's Department of Employment. It's been a nightmare, said Craig. It was a good week for adaptation. After Texas' first waterless water park opened in drought-hit Katy, Texas. "A lot of us grew up going to the water park," said the manager of the slide-filled Slick City. "This is indoors, without the sun, without the water. It's just a different concept." It was a good week for having a doctor in the Senate after Senator Rand Paul successfully performed the Heimlich maneuver on Senator Joni Ernst as she choked at a Republican luncheon. "God bless Rand Paul," said Senator Lindsey Graham, a longtime Paul adversary. "I never thought I'd say that." But it was a bad week for transparency after Speaker Mike Johnson announced that House Republicans are blurring the faces of rioters in footage of the January 6th Capitol attack before releasing it publicly because we don't want them to be retaliated against and to be charged by the DOJ. It's a bad week for motions after the Ohio Supreme Court suspended the law license of an attorney who admitted to defecating in Pringles cans and leaving them in parking lots. Jack Blakesley said he enjoyed imagining the look of surprise on the face of whoever discovered his handiwork. Finally, it was a bad week for self-effacement after a city council candidate in Rainier, Washington, who decided not to cast a ballot in the election, lost to his opponent by a single vote, 247-246. "I didn't feel comfortable voting for myself," said Damian Green. "I thought it was kind of narcissistic, so I didn't." Briefing page. An elusive peace in the Middle East. A two-state solution has been presented for decades as the answer to the Israel-Palestinian conflict. Is it still possible? What is the two-state solution? The establishment of two independent states west of the Jordan River, one Israeli and one Palestinian. The plan has its roots in World War I when British wrested control of what was then called Palestine from the Ottoman Empire and issued the 1917 Balfour Declaration, a statement of support for Zionism and the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. At the time, Palestine had a majority Arab Muslim population with Jewish and Christian minorities. But Balfour's promise of a Jewish state in the ancient Jewish homeland, as well as Nazi persecution and the Holocaust, led hundreds of thousands of Jews to migrate to Palestine. As immigration increased, so did clashes between Palestinian Arabs and Jews. In 1947, as Britain prepared to exit the territory, the United Nations voted to partition Palestine into Jewish and Palestinian states, with Jerusalem to be administered by the UN. Jewish leaders accepted the plan, which allocated the Jewish state 56% of the land, but many Palestinian Arabs rejected it. Civil war broke out, and after Israel declared independence in May 1948, five Arab nations attacked the new nations. Did the war change Israel's border? Israel pushed back the Arab armies, and by the time fighting stopped in March 1949, it controlled 77% of the former Palestine, including West Jerusalem. An estimated 700,000 Palestinians fled or were driven from their homes. A mass displacement known in Arabic as Nakba, catastrophe. Many headed to the West Bank, where Jordan took control, and Gaza, which was occupied by Egypt. Both territories were seized by Israel during the Six-Day War of 1967, as was Palestinian-majority East Jerusalem. Israeli settlements soon began to appear in the occupied West Bank, the biblical regions of Judea and Samaria, which some settlers believe they are restoring to the Jewish people. On land, Palestinians considered part of their future state. How that state might be created went largely unaddressed until the historic 1978 deal between Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, brokered by President Jimmy Carter at Camp David. What was agreed to at Camp David? The Camp David Accords set the foundation for the 1979 Egyptian-Israeli Peace Treaty, the first such pact between Israel and an Arab neighbor, and proposed a five-year transition period in the West Bank and Gaza, leading to full autonomy for Palestinians. The Palestinians refused to join the next round of talks, and the gap between Israeli and Egyptian visions of Palestinian self-government proved unbridgeable. Bubbling Palestinian anger over Israel's military occupation erupted in 1987 as the First Intifada. Palestinians took part in mass protests and strikes. Some also attacked Israelis. Israel responded with a crackdown, and more than 1,000 Palestinians and 160 Israelis were killed over 6 years of violence. How did the First Intifada end? Secret negotiations in Norway between Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which had waged a terrorist campaign against Israel, produced the 1993 Oslo Accords. Signed on the White House lawn with PLO leader Yasser Arafat, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, and President Bill Clinton looking on, the agreement saw the PLO renounce terrorism and recognize Israel's right to exist. It also created the Palestinian Authority to serve as a temporary five-year government in the West Bank and Gaza, while negotiators addressed the roadblocks to Palestinian statehood. "We who have fought against you, the Palestinians," said Rabin, "we say to you today in a loud and clear voice, enough of blood and tears." Polls showed a majority of Israelis and Palestinians supported the deal, but follow-up negotiations on the conflict's most intractable issues went nowhere. What were those issues? They included the borders of a Palestinian state, the status of Jerusalem, claimed by both Israelis and Palestinians as their capital, and the right of return for Palestinian refugees. As talks dragged on, the situation on the ground deteriorated. Rabin was assassinated by a Jewish extremist in 1995, and Palestinians grew increasingly resentful of corruption inside the Arafat-led Palestinian Authority. In a final attempt at peace, President Clinton brought Arafat and Israeli Minister Ehud Barak to Camp David in July 2000. He proposed a Palestinian state comprising the Gaza Strip and 92% of the West Bank. Israel would grant the Palestinians some land in exchange for keeping West Bank settlement blocks home to about 80% of Jewish settlers, while the Palestinians would control parts of Jerusalem. Barak accepted the plan, but Arafat rejected it as insufficient, leading Clinton to warn Arafat that he was leading his people to a catastrophe. 2 months later, the bloody Second Intifada exploded. The nascent Palestinian terrorist group Hamas targeted Israeli civilians with suicide bombings, and Israeli trust in the Oslo process collapsed. How likely is a two-state solution now? Hopes are slim at best. Even before the October 7th attacks and the war in Gaza, only about a third of Israelis and Palestinians supported a two-state solution, an all-time low. And the barriers to creating a Palestinian state are increasingly high. In 1993, some 110,000 settlers lived in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, Today it's 700,000. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has voiced opposition to a Palestinian nation, and Hamas, which controls Gaza and is increasingly popular in the West Bank, has vowed to destroy Israel. Still, President Biden continues to champion a two-state solution, and international support for such a plan is unlikely to die. There are no other viable alternatives, said Middle East analyst Yossi Mechelberg. The two-state solution is the least bad option. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with no immunity for Trump on January 6th. Donald Trump suffered a devastating blow last week to his legal strategy for escaping accountability for January 6th, said Jennifer Rubin. In separate rulings, judges dismissed Trump's claim that his attempt to overturn the 2020 election was an official presidential act and ruled that he can be sued by police officers hurt during the insurrection and criminally prosecuted by the Justice Department for directing an alleged conspiracy. In the criminal case brought by Special Counsel Jack Smith, federal judge Tanya S. Chutkan demolished Trump's claim that he has absolute immunity for actions taken while he was president. Trump's four-year term did not bestow on him the divine right of kings, she wrote in a stinging opinion, noting that there is no precedent for his claim of total immunity. That same day, a three-judge panel of federal appeals court in D.C., including a Trump appointee, rejected the former president's claim of blanket civil immunity for the January 6 riot, saying his efforts to stay in office were campaign activities, not presidential duties. Chutkan's ruling means Trump will likely go on trial as scheduled on March 4th, with prosecutors armed with devastating facts. The likely Republican nominee may run for president as a convicted felon. The left's revival of Jim Crow. School officials in Evanston, Illinois, are going to give segregation a shot again, said Jeffrey Blehar. Test scores in the progressive Chicago suburb have been falling, particularly among black and Latino students from low-income households. Rather than revamp the curriculum and teaching methods, the school board has decided to take a page from the Jim Crow era and give minority students the option to be put into black or Latino affinity classes that have no white students. Similar programs exist in Oakland and Minneapolis. The theory behind this program, one educator explained, is that in integrated classes, black students are expected to conform to a white standard. This voluntary resegregation raises a number of troubling questions. Should only black and Latino students be eligible for affinity classes? Why can't Asians, Native Americans, and Jews also have classes of their own? Isn't public education supposed to socialize young children and adolescents into the world they'll be entering, rather than separate them into defining racial categories? Progressive educators in Evanston clearly have no idea how to fix the intractable problem of underperforming minority students. Their backward response should shock the American conscience. This is one of the business columns. The fake workplace misery crisis. Don't believe the myth that everyone is miserable at work, said Derek Thompson. For the past 3 years, the business press has been desperate to explain the state of workplace misery. It started in 2021 with the Great Resignation, which was covered as though workers everywhere were smashing their laptops and quitting on the spot. In reality, more Americans were just breaking up with their old employers and getting higher-paying jobs. But then it appeared everyone was instead quiet quitting, a growing epidemic of employee boredom and disengagement. This one is actually rooted in some truth. Yes, people commonly feel bored and disengaged at work. Stop the presses. Now a new misery narrative has taken hold based on a recent Gallup survey that shows increasing numbers of Americans who say they are angry, stressed, and disengaged. For context, however, Gallup has also found that employee engagement in the United States is higher than in Australia, Canada, and every country in Europe, and more than six times higher than Japan. Another survey recently found that employee satisfaction has actually been on the rise for 12 years in a row. How to reconcile these contrasting portraits of the collective psyche? Here's a stab. Work is mostly necessary, often boring, frequently annoying, occasionally insulting, and sometimes rewarding. That's not news. The last word, our in-depth piece, titled this week, Guarding the Final Frontier. Space Force has faced skepticism and mockery since its 2019 founding, said John Gertner in the New York Times Magazine. But the mission of this secretive military branch is more important than ever. Chief Master Sergeant Ron Lurch of the U.S. Space Force sat down in his office in Los Angeles one morning in September to deliver a briefing known as a threat assessment. The current threats in space are less sci-fi than you might expect, but there are a surprising number of them. At least 44,500 space objects now circle Earth, including 9,000 active satellites, and 19,000 significant pieces of debris. What's most concerning isn't the swarm of satellites, but the types. We know that there are kinetic kill vehicles, Lurch said. For example, a Russian nesting doll satellite in which a big satellite releases a tiny one, and the tiny one releases a mechanism that can strike and damage another satellite. There are machines with the ability to cast nets and extend grappling hooks, too. China, whose presence in space now far outpaces Russia's, is launching unmanned space planes into orbit, testing potentially unbreakable quantum communication links, and adding AI capabilities to satellites. In Lurch's assessment, space looked less like a grand new ocean for exploration, phrasing meant to induce wonder that has lingered from the Kennedy administration, and more like a robotic battlefield where the conflicts raging on Earth would soon extend ever upward. The Space Force, the sixth and newest branch of the U.S. military, was authorized by Congress and signed into law by President Donald Trump in December 2019. Its creation was not a partisan endeavor, though Trump has boasted that the idea for the organization was his alone. The initiative had, in fact, been shaped within the armed forces and Congress over the previous 25 years, based on the premise that as satellite and space technologies evolved, America's military organizations had to change as well. At its incarnation, the Space Force was an assemblage of programs and teams that already existed, mainly as entities within the Air Force. The new directive groups space endeavors under a central chain of command and authorizes its leaders to chart a unified future. From the start, the Space Force had detractors. Air Force officials wondered if it was necessary, while some political observers believed that it signified the start of a dangerous and expensive militarization of another realm. What seemed harder to argue against was how nearly every aspect of modern warfare and defense, intelligence, surveillance, communications, operations missile detection has come to rely on links to orbiting satellites. The recent battles in Eastern Europe, in which Russia has tried to disrupt Ukraine's space-borne communication systems, are a case in point. And yet the strategic exploitation of space now extends well beyond military concerns. Satellite phone systems have become widespread. Positioning and timing satellites, such as GPS, now overseen by the Space Force, allow for digital mapping, navigation, banking, and agricultural management. Modern life is reliant on space technologies to an extent that an interruption would create profound economic and social distress. The work of the Space Force is, by its nature, highly sensitive, often classified, and mostly out of sight. This leaves the organization in a battle for visibility and, at times, viability. Some members of the force, guardians as they're called, told me that even now they find themselves bumping into members of other branches of the military who see their arm patches and ask, in earnest, Space Force, is that a real thing? The Steve Carell Netflix comedy series, which members of the actual Space Force sometimes argue is neither good nor funny, doesn't help their cause. It likewise doesn't capture their seriousness of purpose. For the moment, the force has taken up a problem not often contemplated outside science fiction. How do you fight a war in space? Or a war on Earth that expands into space? And even if you're ready to fight, how do you make sure you don't have a space war in the first place? The Space Force's Operations Division is headquartered in southeastern side of Colorado Springs, in a massive three-story building within the guarded perimeter of Peterson Space Force Base. The officers' inner workings are highly secure and secretive. The force, as one security analyst told me, has a larger proportion of its budget, around $26 billion this year, dedicated to classified spending than any other branch of the military. Visitors to headquarters are not allowed to bring electronic devices or walk unescorted inside. All told, the Space Force has about 8,600 military guardians and about 5,000 civilian guardians. Guardians tend to think of the realm they patrol as a kind of structured, multi-level terrain, Earth as being surrounded by three highways, or three rings. The nearest level, Low Earth Orbit, LEO, is host to constellations like SpaceX's Starlink network and the International Space Station, which moves about 250 miles above us at 17,500 miles per hour. A medium Earth orbit, MEO, between 1,200 and 22,000 miles above, is where GPS satellites circle. At the highest ring, at least for now, is a track known as geosynchronous orbit, GEO, because an object in such an orbit keeps pace with the Earth's rotation. This band is home to DirecTV satellites, weather tracking instruments from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and crucial Defense Department communication links. It's a technological zoo up there. The satellite mix is foreign and domestic, young and old, sinister and peaceful. The technologies are all different sizes, flying at different speeds and altitudes. The challenge for the force is to monitor all movement, but also to track the threatening presence of debris, some of which is naturally occurring, tiny rocks, for instance, and some of which has human origins, like shards of old rockets. Keeping track of 44,500 items moving around the planet, along with new arrivals that slip into orbit nearly every week, poses a multidimensional task. Who launched these machines? Why? What could they do? We need to know what's up there, where is it going, and why we should be concerned. Colonel Byron McLean of the Space Force told me, this goal, known as space domain awareness, has become one of the force's overarching priorities. There are enormous challenges in creating a system of constant observation and making sense of so much data. what constitutes threatening activities in orbit, moreover, and what might necessitate a strategic response is not always clear. In truth, space has few unquestioned laws apart from those relating to gravity. A treaty from the late 1960s, signed by most of the major nations on Earth, prohibits the use of nuclear weapons in space and designates the moon for peaceful purposes. But recently, I was told, satellites from foreign adversaries have been coming close to machines from the United States and its allies. The treaty says nothing about such provocations or about grappling hooks, nesting dolls, and cyber warfare. Space leaders readily describe their guardians as working toward a state of combat readiness, even as they hope an era of actual conflict never arrives. In October, I went to the Pentagon to meet with General Chance Saltzman, the chief of space operation at the Space Force's highest-ranking officer. Saltzman remarked that several decades back, when he began working with satellites in the Air Force, the notion that there could be combat losses in space was not part of the conversation. But those are discussions now, he told me, because both the Chinese and the Russians have demonstrated operational capabilities that truly place those assets at risk. In 2007, China's decision to test an ASAT anti-satellite missile to destroy one of its own satellites sent shockwaves through the U.S. military and created a vast field of debris. A similar Russian tactic in 2021 generated more than 1,500 fragments and led Secretary of State Antony Blinken to describe the act as recklessly conducted. The Space Force's own squadron, Saltzman told me, were still tracking pieces of the junk that date to the 2007 explosion. You know, the other domains kind of clean themselves up after war, Saltzman said. You shoot an airplane down, it falls out of the sky, ships sink out of the sea lanes. Even on land, you bring the bulldozers in and you move things around. But space doesn't heal itself. I asked Saltzman what he and his colleagues had learned from observing the war in Ukraine. With a caveat that the fighting is hardly over, it could still be a catastrophe on a grand scale, he said. He pointed to several crucial events. The first was how one of Russia's earliest endeavors was to not deny Ukrainian troops access to a satellite communications system they relied upon, known as Viasat, which is stationed in the distant geosynchronous orbital belt. And they did it with a cyber attack against the ground infrastructure, he said. So you attack the ground network to achieve the space effect you want. Another crucial point came after the attack. Ukraine's decision to go to a commercial vendor, SpaceX, and use its Starlink system for combat communications. Here, the lesson was twofold. First, that what Saltzman called commercial augmentation could prove vital in a crisis. As important, he added, Starlink, a configuration of hundreds of proliferated small satellites flying in low Earth orbit, has proved hard to bring down. And the takeaway is that proliferated systems of many small machines in low orbit can be more technologically resilient to hacking and disruption than a few big machines in higher orbits. If I have two or three satellite communications doing nuclear command and control, maybe those are targets, he explained. But if I take nuclear command and control and spread it across 400 satellites that are zipping over the horizon every 15 minutes, there's a targeting problem. How many satellites do I have to shoot down now to take out the U.S. nuclear command and control? If an adversary believes that it cannot achieve a military objective, Saltzman remarked, it will hesitate to cross a threshold of violence. No conflicts, no debris, no crisis. There is a darker side that accompanies a future of rampant growth. As space becomes commercialized, it increasingly becomes a geopolitical arena for competition, too. Just as China launched a space plane that stayed aloft for months, so has the U.S. Space Force. just as competitors develop satellites that make close and unnerving approaches to our satellites, so does the U.S. Space Force. With so many launches now planned and so many designs for enigmatic satellites in the works, it becomes hard not to wonder if the United States will become engaged in a new arms race, or to ask if it already has. In 1950, a political scientist named John Hertz introduced the term security dilemma, noting that in international affairs, a state concerned with being attacked, subjected, dominated, or annihilated by others can be drawn into a vicious circle of building up its defenses. One implication of this, a political scientist named Robert Jervis later posited, is that one state's gain in security inadvertently threatens others. When I asked Saltzman if that was a concern, he acknowledged that it was, but he also said that the security dilemma was a phenomenon that probably dated back thousands of years. Weapons are not inherently offensive or defensive, Saltzman maintained. Weapons are just weapons, and the operations that you choose to undertake with those weapons makes them more offensive or defensive. The important question, as he saw it, was this: at what point does a buildup of defensive weapons in space constitute an ability to conduct offensive operations so that someone else feels threatened? There is a balance here, he said, and this is about stability management. What actions can we take to protect ourselves before we start to cross the line and maybe create a security dilemma? The line, he suggested, harder to find in space, no doubt, and at this point not clearly defined, has not yet been crossed. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. Here's an obituary. The Supreme Court Justice who blazed a trail for women, Sandra Day O'Connor, 1930 to 2023. During her 24 years on the Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor was the most powerful woman in America. A rancher's daughter who became the first female justice, she was such a pivotal force at the ideological center that pundits refer to it as the O'Connor Court, even though William Rehnquist was Chief Justice for most of her tenure. From restrictions on abortion to the dispute over the 2000 presidential election, it was O'Connor's position that largely dictated the law. She projected unflinching confidence, yet when she learned she was President Reagan's choice to fill a court vacancy in 1981, she got nervous. "It's all right to be the first to do something, but I didn't want to be the last woman on the Supreme Court," she said. "If I took the job and did a lousy job, it would take a long time to get another one." Sandra Day grew up on her family's Arizona cattle ranch, the Lazy Bee, riding horses and doing chores. There was no electricity or running water until she was 7, and during the school year, she would stay with her grandmother in El Paso. "She excelled in school, skipped 2 grades, and enrolled at Stanford at age 16, said the New York Times. At Stanford Law School, she dated Rehnquist, a fellow student. But then she met John O'Connor III and married him after graduating in 1952. While O'Connor finished near the top of her class, she couldn't get a job practicing law, said Politico, as firm after firm told her, "We don't hire women." Instead, she worked in the public sector, had 3 sons, and then got involved in Republican politics in Arizona. In 1969, when she was Assistant State Attorney General, she was appointed to fill a vacancy in the state Senate and won re-election twice. That gave her a background as a legislator that became key to her later views on states' rights and the primacy of the legislature over the judiciary in determining law. Reagan appointed O'Connor as a conservative, said the Washington Post, but she never went far enough in any way of the law to fully satisfy either conservatives or liberals. In 1986, she cast a decisive vote in Bowers v. Hardwick, which upheld a sodomy ban, And in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992, she crafted the undue burden doctrine that preserved Roe's right to abortion. By the 90s, said Slate, she was the court's swing vote, writing decisions aimed at the moderate center. She appeared partisan, though, when she decided with the conservatives in Bush versus Gore, handing George W. Bush the presidency. O'Connor inspired generations of female lawyers in a time of overt sexism. After liberal Ruth Bader Ginsburg joined the court, male lawyers frequently confused the two, even though they looked nothing alike, prompting O'Connor to wear a T-shirt saying, "I'm Sandra, not Ruth." She worked through a bout with breast cancer and retired in 2006 to care for her husband, who had dementia. While she often lamented the court's rightward turn, she maintained pride in her historic career. In terms of having the American people look at the court and think of it as being fair, she said, it helps to have women, plural, on the court. And on the Talking Points page, Trump, is America sleepwalking toward a dictatorship? It's time to stop the wishful thinking and face the stark reality, said Robert Kagan in the Washington Post. There is a clear path to dictatorship in the United States, and it's getting shorter every day. On March 5th, when more than a dozen states hold their Super Tuesday primaries, Donald Trump will lock up the GOP presidential nomination. He's already leading his closest competitor by about 50 points, and the Republican establishment will rally around him. Anyone who thinks that four looming criminal trials will drain his support and cost Trump the November election is delusional. He is tied or ahead of President Biden in all the latest polls. If Trump regains the White House, he will enter office in a vengeful rage, determined to flex his muscle and punish his enemies. To root out, he recently vowed, the radical left thugs who live like vermin in the U.S. And he'll face the fewest constraints of any president in history. There will be no sober adults in a second Trump cabinet to thwart his worst impulses, and an increasingly anti-democratic Republican Party won't check him. Having triumphed despite indictments, courtroom appearances, and possibly a conviction, he may refuse to obey unfavorable Supreme Court rulings. The nation will have begun an irreversible descent into dictatorship. Trump's campaign trail speeches are increasingly violent and authoritarian, said Charles Savage in the New York Times. He's declared that immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country, called for the shootings of shoplifters, and suggested the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, should be executed for treason. Trump and his allies have signaled their willingness to weaponize the Justice Department to pursue foes and critics, including the Biden family and Trump's former Attorney General Bill Barr, invoke the Insurrection Act, and send troops into U.S. cities to eliminate dissent and round up millions of undocumented immigrants in detention camps. MAGA World aims to push through this radical second-term agenda by stocking the federal bureaucracy with loyalists, said Jim Vandehei and Mike Allen in Axios. Led by former aide Stephen Miller and allies at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, a highly coordinated campaign is underway to remove long-standing protections for civil service workers, purge those deemed disloyal, and replace them with fervent Trumpers who will question no orders. Thousands of potential foot soldiers are already being screened with questionnaires and scourings of their social media histories. The return of Trump would shake not just the U.S. but the world, said Ann Applebaum in The Atlantic. He'll try to pull the U.S. out of NATO, something he's threatened to do at the alliance's 2018 summit. Even if he hits roadblocks, it won't matter. NATO's deterrent effect hinges on the belief that an attack on one alliance member will trigger a response from all other members, especially the U.S. That deterrent dies the moment it's clear Trump won't come to the rescue. Europe's defense strategy would be thrown into chaos. Russia could steamroll through Ukraine, and all of America's other security alliances would be in jeopardy. Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and strong men everywhere would be empowered by America's retreat. You'd think such a supposedly fatal threat would wake up Democrats, said Charles C.W. Cook in National Review. Yet despite polls repeatedly showing that the public dislikes their candidate and loathes his understudy, party leaders remain committed to a Joe Biden-Kamala Harris ticket. What the hell are Democrats thinking? The same could be asked of voters, said A.B. Stoddard in The Bulwark. Trump leads commandingly in swing state polls, and even many young black and Hispanic voters trust him more on the economy, immigration, and foreign policy. Meanwhile, the anti-MAGA coalition of 2020 is splintering amid gripes about inflation and Biden's Israel policies. A second Trump term could destroy democracy, but many voters don't know that, don't believe it, or don't care. We are stumbling into a landscape of unthinkable scenarios, said David Frum in The Atlantic. Would the Senate confirm Trump nominees selected because they supported his January 6th coup attempt? Will Justice Department staffers resign when told to prosecute Trump adversaries? Will Americans march in the streets? And will the military obey orders to crush protest? It's tempting to dismiss such questions. Democracy survived one Trump term, after all, and we can take false comfort in believing it will weather a second. But the human imagination often fails when turned to the future. History is full of moments of crisis, chaos, and revolution. We know that such things happened years or decades or centuries ago. We cannot believe they might happen tomorrow. And it looks like we've run a little long today. So with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.